Everybody ready to roll? Welcome, folks. Happy to have everybody here. People with the stamina and the energy that are still here, that's great. Good to see you. This panel is the Clubhouse Confidential panel. If any of you watch the show, it's billed as the show for the thinking fan. So I think you can say this conference is the conference for the thinking fan. We're just hoping to add a little bit to it. The four of us all appear on the show from time to time. I think you know everybody on the panel: Dave Cameron from Fangraphs, Jay Jaffe from Baseball Prospectus. Happy to have him on board. And of course, Rob Nyer from SB Nation, and myself. So we're going to have an open dialogue about some things that we're going to toss out there, all comment on, and then we're going to open it up to questions from the crowd and just sort of wrap things around. I thought I'd start off with a topic that we talk about from time to time as we study players and make forecasts and think about the upcoming season, and that is, who would you say is the most, or one of the most, underrated players in the game? Now, he doesn't get the kind of love that he should get, given how good he is to start the game.
So I think my guy is like the lowest under the radar guy possible. So I'm like the world's biggest Will Venable fan. I know like no one feels like a Will Venable. Like, why is he sitting there talking about Will Venable? I love Will Venable. Like, me, this is a guy who exemplifies why we have park effects. He's a left-handed, extremely full power guy in the one park that on Earth designed to kill left-handed full power guys. So you look at his home run splits and they're enormous. But it's not just those. Like, if you look at the balls he hits at home, he gets absolutely destroyed by his home park. The Padres platoon him really heavily, and because he doesn't hit a lot of home runs and he doesn't walk a lot, his overall numbers don't look great. So they see him as like a part-time backup center fielder type, gonna get like 400 plate appearances a year. I think any team in baseball who doesn't have Petco as their home park and easily trades a little bit, will stick him in the center field and have a 2-3 win center fielder making basically nothing before his pre-arb years. I think Venable's the kind of guy who a smart team can say, hey, look, this center field is really expensive. I don't want to spend for Michael Bourne next winter. I don't want to spend for DJ Upton next winter. I'm just going to get this corner outfielder stuck in the wrong park, put him in the center field, watch him turn into like a, 270, 330, 400 guy with 15 homers, 15 stolen bases, pretty good defense, and I'm going to get him for next time. So I'm going way down the hole for my underrated guy, but I love the little guy.
New York, I have to say Derek Jeter. So
the guy that I think of who popped into my head, but then I went upstairs, I did a little bit of research to back my case, is Yovani Gallardo of the Brewers. He's not generally considered to be an ace. Career ERA is about 3.7, but he strikes out about 8 guys per 9. But there's a hidden value there, and that's his offense. He's got a 650 OPS for his career. And for the last 3 years, he's been worth an extra win per year with his bat. 200 inning guy who doesn't have to be pitch hit for, who could out hit the Mariners DHs.
Just with Fangraphs and BP, we're hitting the ball.
Right, exactly. No, he's a really special player because when you add in the fact that he's able to produce runs as well as prevent them, I think that raises his standing a bit. He doesn't get quite enough credit for that.
I don't have a name, although I'll bet one of these guys can help me. But I think that, first of all, it's really hard to be underrated by us anymore.
Yeah, that's true.
Because Fangraphs actually added base running, which is what one of the last frontiers of underratedness. But
we had that for years.
Really?
Yeah, we've had it for like 4 years. So we haven't been easy to find for that.
That's...
Even a shot at my DHs.
But I will say that there are a few guys out there at any one time who are really good base runners, not base fielders, but just good base runners, and really good fielders that don't win gold gloves, and decent hitters. Those are the most underrated players out there. And one of these years, one of those guys that hit a huge contract, people are going to go, what? How can they give him $20 million a year? And the reason is because he's doing these other things that most people still aren't paying attention to. Anybody come to mind? If I had a computer, I can find the
answer. I generally tend to freeze up on these
questions. Jay Sutley was sort of that guy, because he's a great base runner when he plays, and a great fielder. I don't think there's one gold glove. And he should have stay at MVP, like in the top three or four, like 3 or 4 years. He was. But he's not that guy anymore. He's not
I think
he was that guy.
The guy that comes to my mind is a guy who like seven. I'll get up with Tyler Green because in St. Louis they're kind of giving Frank Mays a job too. If you look at him, he's like a 90% base dealer in the lineup. He's like 21 for 21 in the major leagues in like very limited time. He's a maybe the best base runner in baseball right now that no one talks about. He's a decent enough second base and yeah, power. He's really good. Everyone looks at the Cardinals this year. They have a huge hole in second base. I'm like, Tyler Green could be top 10 second base this year. And that skill set pretty hard.
I mean,
my guy would be James Shields. You could say, well, wait a minute, this guy's already pretty highly touted ball player. I would have him in the top 10 pitchers in baseball and a candidate for a future Cy Young. To me, James Shields is the right-handed version of Cole Hamels. Throws the changeup like Cole Hamels does. Has great performance against left-handed hitters. And really has stats that are very similar to Hamels, not in every area. I just, you know, and I had him in my starting pitcher rating system, which gives a lot of credit to pitching deep in the game, I have to admit that. Where, you know, he has been a horse. And in my starting pitcher rating system last year, I had him rated number 2 behind Burlinger. Now, the game system may be rating a little high, but I really think James Shields is a top 10 pitcher in the major leagues. There's a lot of names that I could throw out there that I don't think are really quite as good as Shields.
You know, I'm still bitter. 2 years ago, I predicted James Shields would win the American League Cy Young, and he was an ERA 5.5, and I got mocked endlessly. And then last year, he was amazing. I was like, where was that? Just flip them, and I would believe you're a genius.
How about this one? How about, what's the biggest strategic flaw that you see happening during games? In-game strategy flaw that you see that irritates you every time you see it?
Intentional walk, I think. I think especially in the World Series, we saw this one just so crazy with the intentional walk. So like they are so afraid of this hitter beating them, they say, I'm not going to let that guy beat me, so I'm going to put this guy on base and then make my pitcher pitch with the bases loaded so he can get no margin for error, he can't pitch on the corners anymore, and then if he gets extra base in, he drives him another run. And so I think Ron Washington absolutely killed himself in the World Series with the intentional walk. And it's one of these things that is, it's not even really a gray area, this is monstrously bad. This is not something that is very defensible. You know, sometimes you can talk about platoon splits and their effects on hitter psyche or something. It's really hard to argue there's these intangible things we're missing. I think, you know, managers vastly underrating the negative effects of the intentional walk.
Yeah, I tend to go with the it's maybe more of a roster thing than just an in-game. I mean, it has its ramifications in-game, but you know, the tendency towards larger pitching staffs and smaller benches, and you know more of these, like bringing in the lefty guy, the lefty reliever, and you end up pitch hitting and neutralizing that advantage. And a lot of these, you know, lefty specialists can't get righties out. So it's a movement that's almost, you know, completely self-defeating.
Those are the two best ones. Thank you, guys. These I have two. There are two actually. They're sort of operational and strategic because the players do it, but drives me nuts. And I've never seen a study. When you get to the outfield, run on second, scores, and the batter takes off the second base and gets caught and run down. It happens, like, I see like every week, and I can't figure out why you keep doing it. It's just giving away base runners, because the guy would have been safe at home almost every time. The other one is, I mean, sort of inspired by John Dewan's Fielding Bible and the article about the shift, the infield shift. I just can't figure out why more hitters don't bunt down the third baseline and buck into hitters and shift on it. It's a free hit. Man, I've got to be at least 455 to do anything because they're not very good. So that judging will be.
Mine is an in-game move where the manager lifts the pitcher to optimize the batter-pitcher matchup, even in a medium or low-level situation. I think it's a very short-term oriented move. It's putting the opportunity of retiring the batter from, you know, 65% and raising it to 70% or 68% or 71%, you burn a pitcher from the bullpen, you set a cascading process that starts your bullpen churning, all because you don't want to take the 65% chance of getting the batter out, you want to raise it to 68 or 69 or 70. And I think it's, you know, it's commonplace enough all the time. I just think it's a bad short-term move. And particularly with lifting starters, now it's one thing if the starter's hitting the wall, based but I just think it happens way too frequently. I just think it's a mindset that's, it's just very short term. And I realize the manager's job is focused on winning each and every game, but I really think they need to think just a little broader than that. Think to that next game, to the next game, in terms of how you're using it. Reaction to that?
Yeah, I think the really problem with that, I found it interesting the reaction to Joe Girardi's strategy in the playoffs, where Von Nova went inning and had a mysterious arm thing because he looked very good and they wanted to bring in better relief pitchers. And like me, I have a pet theory because I have no evidence and I'm not a doctor, so I can't say for sure. But it seemed like Nova wasn't pitching very well and they had better relievers and this would be a good win. I think that teams in high leverage, late season situations, it actually go the opposite way of this. I think that using a five-man starting rotation down the stretch when you're going to the playoffs a lot is foolish. You've got 27 pitchers on the roster because we expanded to 40-man rosters in September, and relief pitchers pitch better than starters, and I think that team in the playoff contention in September should abandon the five-man rotation and throw as many relievers and throw as long as we can and just be like, hey, I'm going to throw away Holiday and then the other 40 other bullpen days. You're just going to get reliever after reliever after reliever in a five-hour game, and then we're going to play off.
You're talking about just when the rosters
expand. Yeah, just in September.
Well, kind of along the same vein, though. A lot of the non 12-man pitching staffs, 7-man bullpen, that we missed having an extra hitter on the bench, right? But has anybody ever actually studied the qualitative difference between having an extra pitcher and having an extra hitter? I've never seen that.
It's tough for me to conceptualize how to study that. I certainly know that there are breeds of player that we seem to be missing, like a good hitting catcher who doesn't actually catch much and maybe gets more pinch hitting. Three catcher rosters, we don't see that anymore. You used to be able to do so much more with that extra guy on the bench, so you can do a lot of offensive moves. So I think going back to what I was saying, to me, it seems like that if you can so easily neutralize the platoon advantage by bringing in a righty to face a lefty, and granted, you have if your roster is matching the other guy's roster, you've only got so many of those bullets you can fire too, because you've got a 4-man bench.
I think there are so many times when I'm watching a game and a weak hitter comes up and the manager doesn't pitch it for him. And I don't know if that's because the bench is not long enough or because I really get the impression that managers are hesitant to pinch hit these days, especially in the American, because they don't want to upset that weak pinch hit.
Right, it's like an embarrassment.
I mean, how many times do you see a weak hitting shortstop bat in the ninth inning in a key spot, and there's a better hitter on the bench, and you wonder why they don't do it?
I actually wonder if this is due to more information. So I think for years, we've just always looked at it and said, oh, this guy's an 850 OPS guy sitting on the bench, and that guy's a 750 OPS guy in the lineup, we should totally pinch hit. And then, in the fuck, Tango and the Dolphin did this. The study about pinch hitting, there's a significant pinch hitting penalty where it's just like a DH penalty where you don't start the game, you sat there for 3 hours, you've done nothing, you perform way worse than your normal. So maybe a 750 OPS guy and an 850 OPS guy, if the 850 OPS guy is pinch hitting, are actually pretty similar. Now you're just burning the roster spot and not actually getting a big advantage.
So you're saying Royals didn't pitch hit for you that before because they read the book?
Absolutely.
That's what I'm saying.
You're a closet genius.
We're all stuck on
that.
I have no words.
I have no words.
I'm still pondering the union back and forth.
Mind blown.
What about, let me ask you this. Pitcher's ability to induce ground balls seems to get a lot of attention these days. Is it overrated or underrated, would you say today, in terms of the mindset of the industry, even the ball leaders in the industry, in terms of the Are we giving enough credit to ground ball pitchers? I had a general manager say to me recently, I think we're pulling too much of the love of ground ball pitchers. Where do you see
it? I see where you're coming from. I've had actually a couple more on tell me the same thing because I think they're tired of guys like Derek Lowe getting these huge contracts and then not performing that well. I think it's a reaction to guys like that, just by Brooks. Some of these ground ball guys have gotten huge contracts and failed. I still think overall ground ball pitchers are a little bit underrated because of the fascination with projecting pitchers almost solely by strikeout rate. So if you see a young pitcher coming up to the minors, he's almost intact. Like 90% of the evaluation on him is going to be strikeout rate. If we don't have a really good scouting report or pitching next to him, but just from the data, it's almost all, this guy misses bats, I like this guy. You'll see this with almost every prospect. This guy has 12 strikeouts per 9, he's amazing. but we don't talk about the fact that, yes, those strikeouts, by pitching up in the zone, getting a lot of fly balls, and probably pitching in an area where, you know, 89 in the majors at that level is going to get a lot of home runs. And so, kind of like Brandon McCarthy was talking about, if you go down in the zone, you're trading strikeouts for ground balls, but it's not necessarily a bad trade-off. Personally, I think ground ball guys, especially minor league ground ball guys, if you look through the history of prospect lists, Brandon Webb was never a top 100 prospect. A lot of the best ground ball guys didn't put up a ton of strikeouts in the minors. They kind of got overlooked. They were like, ah, they're back-end starters, and all of a sudden they get the majors with Daniel Hudson. Pretty darn good with starting pitcher. He ran 7 strikeouts for 9 in double-A, and everyone said, ah, he's a number 5. He gets the majors, and yeah, he's not number 5.
Yeah, I think, you know, ground ball, calling somebody a ground ball pitcher, I mean, it's a label we tend to throw on people as a shorthand to manage our ability to think about hundreds and hundreds of players throughout the 30 teams and their minor league systems. And, you know, to me, it's like, I mean, I want a ground ball pitcher, but I want a ground ball pitcher who also misses bats. Yeah. I mean, you know, that's,
we want both.
Like, you know, it's beer and tacos in a way. So I think it's still, in terms of what the general public sees, you know, maybe not the people in this room because they're, you know, reading, you know, stuff that we write, that we have been writing for years, but I don't think the general public still has as much appreciation of, you know, the difference between ground ball pitchers and fly ball pitchers and how that impacts home run rates and how it impacts batting average and balls in play. You know, a guy who gives up more hits, but they're of less damage versus a guy who gives up fewer hits, but can be more dangerous. It does puzzle me, though, that some teams are so heavily driven in the ground ball direction where they don't have strikeout rate like pitchers who can miss bats, too. I think not to pick on somebody whose work I admire, was talking to earlier, but like, you know, the Indians, for years, I think, were drafting a lot of those guys. This is before people, you know, ex-baseball perspectives now in the front office was there, but like, you look at some of the guys that they took, and they're ground ball pitchers who didn't miss bats, and a lot of those guys didn't pan out, and I think that kind of put the organization to deficit.
Aren't they a lot cheaper, though, too?
Yeah.
I mean, it's expensive to buy people who miss bats, so I think,
yeah,
I think sort of a poor man's pitcher is a ground ball pitcher.
And a ground hitter and a good hitter.
But a lot of them turned into very rich men, though. I mean, just for head-scratching contracts that haven't really panned out, like Derek Lowe is one of them. Kyle Loesch, I would say, is one of them.
They're quite good at that. He had one bad year.
Well, he had a year and a half at all. But it's okay at the front of the contract.
Yeah.
They shouldn't give him 4 years. 15 million a year is not a year.
Because Roger did work out pretty well. You know, he was coming out after having gotten the stock out.
You know what I don't know is, what is a ground ball? What percentage?
50%.
You don't have you.
Yeah, I mean, league average is 43.9, I think, so, you know, 50 is far enough.
Yeah, I thought that's all general. That seems about right to me. And, you know, a few years ago, I mean, back when Nate Silver was, you know, starting up Pocota, I think one of the interesting things that I learned, because I was coming out, you know, first learning about dips, was that ground ball rates correlated year to year even more strongly than strikeout rates. Which, I mean, that's a tremendously useful piece of information to have when you're projecting pitchers and even just to understand the game.
I'm definitely in the camp of that is worth an enormous amount. It's probably still undervalued in the general public, and I'm not sure that the teams have really caught up with the appreciation of what a ground ball pitcher can do. But there's an interesting offset. I think Brian Kenny brought up the other day on the show, right? Segment on reaching based on error made me think that since 40% of all errors are committed by shortstop and third baseman, I'm sure 90% of those are forearm ground balls, it might mean that a left-handed ground ball pitcher has a sort of residual penalty to company. Now, in the grand scheme of things, I mean, Derek Jeter was on the extreme end of the guy who had the highest systematically reaching based on error. I think his was 12 points to his OPS, if you count those as essentially on the reaching base. So maybe the baseline is 6 or 7 points of OPS, but I don't know if that's something we've ever really talked about, like Matt Harrison or something like that. He's probably going to give up more errors.
They're also going to give up more hits, too. I mean, they're just because they don't have the platoon advantage. So I think you see that. You already see some reflection of that in the statistics that we, you know, that is on to find out, but I think that's still...
But then you have to look at the slugging percentage on the fly balls about 2.5 times what it is on the ground ball. So you might be willing to tolerate some of that for the sake of keeping runs off the board too. Your reaction?
I started thinking about knuckleball or something. For the next question.
Yeah, for the next question. Who's your favorite knuckleball?
There's only one left.
What stat do you think that's in the sort of advanced metric category is the most overrated? It gets more attention than it really should.
I think any fielding metric that's being used without an adequate sample size is, I don't want to pick on any given one. I just think the way that they're used, if you say, oh, he's not a good third baseman because he played 30 games there and was 10 months below average, well, that's probably, well, there's more noise than there is really. I think that's it. That bothers me to no end.
And for that, I agree with that. I mean, we have a lot of fielding metrics on our site. We like fielding metrics. If you're quoting someone's UPR in 30 games, that's awful. Don't do that. I would say ERA plus is the one that gets to me a little bit, and it's kind of the default pitching metric of Clubhouse Confidential, which, to me, I think that we've come so far in the last 15, 20 years in understanding pitching that I don't get why we're still doing ERA. Like, it's an okay proxy over 10,000 innings or some long period of time where you've had different defenses behind you and all these things evened out, but over 3 or 4 years, anyone who's going to pitch in Texas for the next 4 years with Adrian Beltre, Elvis Andrus, all these good defenders behind him, you can't just be like, defense, whatever. The Tampa Bay Rays, the pitchers consistently post really low ERAs. A lot of that is because the defenders are behind it, and we understand that ERA is both pitching and defense, and using ERA as a shorthand for just pitching performance in this day and age, I'm not sure why we're doing
that. I think I just learned recently that I don't understand how OPS plus is being talking about. I kind of stopped using it.
I have a bit of a problem with OPS plus too, because it's been shown that on base percentage is maybe twice as valuable as slugging percentage, and if that's the case, then OPS plus, which is weighting those two equally, is undervalued on base, which is why I really tend to gravitate towards BP's true average, because I do like the way that more properly values on base percentage and market adjust as well.
And I will say, so BP's true average and our weighted OPS average are almost exactly the same thing. They're scaled differently. But if you like OPS plus, Fangraphs is something called WRC plus. It's the exact same thing, just without the on base and slugging issue. So basically, you fixed the value of on base percentage in WRC plus. It's the exact same scale. So if you're like, I know that 150 is good, it's 150 is good and booked. Like, it's exactly the same stat, just with the corrected on base.
What about FIP and XFIP and the focus on the feature outcomes and their essentially commitment to deny this ability to use ground balls versus fly balls? I mean, what's your thoughts?
Well, I don't know that either FIP or XFIP. XFIP definitely doesn't need more ground balls because it uses expected home run rate as one of the inputs. And so expected home run rate is based on the number of fly balls you give up. So if you have more ground balls, you have fewer fly balls, your XFIP is going to lower. Excellent gloves ground ball pitchers. It's definitely one of those things that we know that there are certain pitchers who fall outside the range of normalcy. Matt Cain's been giving us fits for 7 years in San Francisco. He won't give up home runs. I don't know why he won't give up home runs. He really should, but he doesn't. There are certainly pitchers like this, knuckleballers, obviously it doesn't work for them. So we understand that there are pitchers who fall outside the range, but for 95% of all pitchers, they're probably a fifth inning next if we're going to be a pretty good approximator of the talent. And I think especially in short sample, where if you want to look at a guy over a 3-4 month period to see how he's pitched, FIP or XFIP are going to give you a better idea than any kind of run pull out metric. Well, if you start getting 5, 6, 7 years, there are guys who don't perform up to FIP rules. You have to look at the results and say, okay, let's find out why, Javier Vasquez for his entire career, outperformed FIP rules. We can look at that and say, he's done this for a long time, let's find out why. But, in a year, 2 years even, I think the FIP and XFIP are a better metric of pitching quality than ERA or even runs level.
I think ERA aspects in general are great shorthands for reducing a lot of complex concepts, and a lot of great research has been done over the years into a single digestible number that says,
you know, this guy's true quality is more of a 4 runs per 9 than a 3.5 runs per 9, something like that. When I do, one of the things I do during the off season is I write for Fantasy Baseball Index. It's a New York State publication, kind of old school. And every year I take, like, you know, the 4 best ERA estimators in my mind out there. That can change year to year as the thinking grows. And I average them together because I want to see, you know, this NLC, wow, this one, these two differ by a half a run here, something like that. And like, looking at those, you can tell, like, okay, well, this is undervaluing because we're out of all rate, or this is, you know, overvaluing his, the luck component of his home run rate, or something like that. And you can sort of tease out where, you know, what, like, the discrepancies between these various estimators, you know, what's really going on there beneath the surface. So I think those are very valuable tools.
I think that's exactly right. Yeah. The reason why you show FIP and XFIP right next to each other,
exactly.
They're not meant to answer a question. They're meant to lead to more questions. That's sort of the point.
Let's turn our attention to the new CBA. A lot of changes in the CBA, probably the most radical CBA since the first time revenue sharing was included in the collective bargaining agreement. So what do you think, have you digested, and what do you think some of the ramifications and implications would be of this new collective bargaining agreement?
I have digested. I don't know if anybody has.
We haven't. It hasn't been published.
But
we know the principles.
What I found incredibly frustrating about the initial news was that everyone rushed to judgment and acted like they knew what it was going to mean, how it was going to. Nobody had any idea yet. It's going to take years for this to play out. There were unintended consequences, and it's going to change a lot of things. To say we know which thing is going to change, I don't know.
I'm pretty bothered by the idea by the limits on spending for the international signings. And I don't know that I fully understand the specifics again because they haven't all been spelled out explicitly for me because I'm not in work for Baseball America and focused on that side of things. You know, I'm not kind of fully focused on that side of things either. But my understanding, it seems like it's going to disincentivize especially Latin America, but just international scouting in general. And it's a roadblock to bringing the best talent into the game. And a bit of a way that teams can sort of get on a different level of playing field if they're towards the back of the draft because they've actually been doing well on the field and not been leaving.
Can we ask a few questions though? Don't you think it will also incentivize other things that you don't know about yet?
Well, but you've also got caps on spending in the draft. I think that, you're just creating more bottlenecks to getting the best talent in the game.
Okay, here's the second question. To what degree is it valuable for Major League Baseball to get the best talent in the game? Would we as fans even notice that the best talent wasn't there?
Never understand this.
That's a good question. I mean, I think, it seems fairly apparent when you study it that, the level of talent has gone up over time in the game. I would hate to think that 20 years from now, when we look back and see where the level of talent has risen like this over time, that suddenly it took this plateau and even leveled off because of these artificial impediments that were solely related to the willingness of the owners to spend money and the union to try to protect its current membership. And they're losing, we already know, for example, that baseball is losing a lot of inner-city athletes of other sports. The percentage of African-American participation has gone down over the years.
Is that because of money, though?
I think it's because of a lot of things. I think that there's definitely, I don't like anything that creates impediments to getting, talent in the game.
I think the concern that I have is that CBA looks to be leveling the playing field across the board in every aspect of organizational competitive advantage, except for Major League payroll. That is the only area where we're like, wow, we're going to have a $200 million payroll, we're going to have a $40 million payroll, and that's okay, but we're not going to have any differences really in international spending, or very small differences. We're going to have very small differences in the draft. We're going to basically shrink all the differences in what you can do creatively in order to, Rays had 145 draft picks last year. That was, not luck. And so they did things to help game the system and get advantage.
And we're basically taking that out of opportunity away from them. Saying, okay, everyone's going to have to spend about the same amount. Like, there's a sliding scale, but it's not a very wide sliding scale. It's much more narrow than it has been in previous years. We're basically saying level playing field in draft, level playing field internationally, level playing field in this, not level playing field at the major league level at all. So we're essentially increasing the impact of major league level. And I think we want to decrease the impact of major league level.
Do you want to go so far as for a salary cap?
So I don't like the salary cap. Personally, I would just do away with the draft. Like, my crazy idea that I wrote on Fangraphs a couple years ago was get rid of the draft, every amateur player is a free agent, and the amount they're allowed to spend on amateur players is directly proportional to the amount they spend on major league players. So you have a $200 million payroll, congratulations, here's $1 million. I told the kids you can move $1 million. You have a $100 million payroll, maybe $20 million. And basically, that's it. Okay, great. So basically, I just want to not penalize teams for success, which I think the draft does, and not make it so that the only differentiator that Major League Baseball teams have is Major League Payroll. And I think that's kind of where the CBA is headed.
But, you know, at the high end of the payroll scale, this $189 million luxury tax threshold, which will be in place for several years, it puts the teams at least at the top end of the payroll scale, the Yankees, maybe the Phillies, puts them in a situation where they're going to be very hard pressed to deceive. They also lose the opportunity to tap into extra revenue sharing too, with the tax threshold. So it's almost the closest thing to our cap. Now I realize it doesn't help the teams have 7 million payroll, but it might bring the Yankees back to the pack from the payroll system. And to me, that's why the Pineda trade was such a better fit than if they had, say, gotten Dave Felix. Because here's a guy who they can now, if they get under the 189 threshold for one season, between 2014, 15, and 16, they unlock a revenue stream that could be up to $60 million over the year.
More revenue for the Yankees? Fantastic.
No, but the point is that they're going to have to do it by the way. You know, I don't mind them getting rich if we can suppress the payroll whether or not we do so. But I think that's an important aspect that really does help the competitive situation. I do think there's other things, though. You know, it does deprive the Pirates from going out and spending $25 million or $20 million. Having, you know, what about all these teams who built academies and put all this infrastructure in place, and now the field is level where they essentially made that, you know, as a commodity purchase out there, and eventually there might even be a draft on the international side. So it is kind of an awkward time right now, but I agree with Rob that it's so hard to judge it because so few of the details have been released. I mean, I remember the day it came out. I mean, Dave, you wrote a scathing article on Fangraphs about it was death of everyone at the Yankees or something.
I'm a little hyperbolic, but yes, I was not a big fan of it, and I remain not a big fan of it.
That was the first time you were hyperbolic.
Yes, yeah. It was a new frontier for me.
You know, this guy, the point you made, I mean, not just the Yankees, the Red Sox, the Scudero trade was purely to save $5 million.
Well, it was to sign Royals, right? Like,
yeah, it was $5 million. That was, I mean, they wanted $5 million they could sign Royals. I mean, a year ago, that wouldn't have happened. Or whatever. I mean, it was working to some degree.
I think there's evidence of the Red Sox being, or not just the Red Sox, but other franchises, even big franchises, doing something like that in the past, where they say, hey, I'll move this guy so I can sign this guy. They've had budget constraints on them before. Like, I don't think this is a new thing. Like, I don't think the Scudero trade, especially because I think the shortstop platoon they have could actually be okay. And I don't think it's a huge step down. But to me, that was the money we're going to trade Scudero so that we have money to sign Roy Oswalt. That didn't make them worse. That just meant that they got to take advantage of this. You know, they didn't actually win anymore in Boston, but the idea was they could take advantage of this free agent who was going to help them more in the guy area.
But the point is that their rich team still has to pick up money.
I think they always have, though, right?
Yeah, I mean,
they have.
But then the Yankees, you know, the Yankees, they do spend more money than anybody else, but they also, if you look at what they've done, you know, over the last few years, they've pretty much hewed to a budget like everybody else. I mean, you know, yes, they've got a little bit more room to take advantage of the, you know, Andy Pettit wants to come back, so yeah, let's throw a couple $1 million at him. You know, that's when you have to take the case up to ownership and offer, you know, authorize that beyond what the GM's already been budgeted. But yeah, I mean, you know, to see that the Yankees and the Red Sox have, like, you know, and I think it's specifically those two teams. I don't think the Phillies are going to approach 189 unless they, you know,
the results
are
going to
be higher. Okay, they're going to have to take that back. They're going to have to resign
more.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. You know, that these, the, you know, even the top spending teams have to act more rationally.
There was a time when we didn't really talk about budget cuts because they really didn't ever apply to anybody. Now it's like nice to have
I mean, for the Yankees, there was somebody writing about this, you know, a couple weeks ago. I mean, the fact that they may have to make a choice between extending Robinson Cano and extending Curtis Granderson, or that they're going to have to, you know, figure out a way to restructure Alex Rodriguez's contract, you know, again, or Teixeira's contract, and just like to get to this 189 figure. There's a lot of complexity just there. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So relating to all this, second wild card. Do you like it, and how does it change the dynamics in July in terms of the trade season, the season trade season?
I'm a big fan. So I think like when I look at baseball in September, and part of this could be being a lifelong Mariner fan, but baseball in September has been not entertaining for a large portion of the teams. So when you buy September, you're playing kids who aren't very good, and quite out the string, and attendance declines, and it's just not very interesting baseball. So to me, even the ability to add interesting games for teams who aren't going to make it, but just we've now made their September games interesting, I think we've raised the level of baseball across the sport without having to, there's not a significant cost. So like, to me, the second wild card makes the first wild card less useful, which is a good thing right now. It was too easy to get into the wild card in the World Series, so it diminishes that, and it makes, you know, a team like Pittsburgh or Cleveland last year, who was kind of a contender and then fell out of the race, doesn't keep them in the race longer, keep their fan bases interested. I think that's the longer we can keep most fan bases interested in coming to the park and enjoying baseball, that's great. And I like the fact that it gives them an advantage. I think this is the best idea yet.
Yeah, I have my reservations about it, at least in the short term, because I don't like the way that it was sort of forced into this year's schedule without the extra, you know, padding for finding and then some 2-3 format. You know, I was a skeptic about the wild card initially, but I kind of grew up in the ability to enjoy it. You know, last year, I was writing about team entropy and just like the fact that there were so many scenarios that could come about towards the end of the year, and it was just absolute chaos. And you could almost like smell the panic of Major League Baseball in terms of trying to figure out what happens if you've got a three-way tie. And it's like, I don't know, but I want to see it. I want to see them sweat. You know, I really enjoy that. I think the wild card has already restored a lot of September interest around, you know, in a lot of places. And I was looking for this a few weeks ago, some study that showed that September attendance, I think, was more broadly up around the game, but I couldn't find the exact study that I was thinking of, and maybe I'm just imagining it. But I think that long term, the right thing to do is to restore more value to winning the division. And you know, we all do. I think the thrill of watching those one game play-ins, you know, we've been blessed with a lot of them over the last few years. I think that'll grow to be something that we really enjoy. So I think it's a good move for the game.
Well, our friend Joe Sheehan is not here, so I'll make his argument for him. Not as well as he would. Joe's BPS number, the biggest one I think, is that you wind up penalizing every so often anyway a really good team, a really good second place team. Because, say, in Joe's example, it's usually going to be the Yankees or somebody. the Yankees and the Red Sox, the Yankees and the Rays, whoever it is. Let's say the Yankees win 96 games and finish 2 games behind the Red Sox. The Yankees are a great team, legitimately, and have to play this one game playoff against, you know, some team that won 88 games. And they could very well lose that game because they were trying to win the division. And maybe the 88 win team wasn't trying hard to last. Who knows? My take is, on balance, that's going to happen rarely enough. And also, I don't feel sorry enough for the Yankees or the Red Sox that I really care a whole lot. I mean, is it fair? No, it's not fair. There are a lot of things that aren't fair. I think, on balance, what you gain, and especially making the division race more meaningful between I'd rather see the thing. I want to see that kind of. I want to see the Yankees and the Red Sox fighting like hell in the last week of the season.
Yeah.
And is it good for them, the loser? No, it's good for us. It's really good for us. As long as we can deal with a little bit less fairness. And I can deal with a little bit less fairness. So I'm okay with it. And I think those one game playoffs are gonna be a lot of fun. So, and somebody did the work, I wish I can't remember who it was. One of the arguments I've heard, it's ridiculous, is that if you had a new setup, you wouldn't have had the last day that we had last year, which was obviously the greatest day in baseball history, arguably. But you're not going to have that again anyway.
Yeah, right.
But if you do all the math and you figure out how much drama you're going to have from one to the other, basically a wash, not including the one game playoffs, which are inherently dramatic. So, as a fan, I think it's going to be a lot of fun. Do I want to see 16 playoff teams every year? I don't. And that's the next step. Well, not the next step. That, this is an intermediate step toward that. And at some point, maybe we'll all go around and say this is too much, but I don't really see any reason to hate what they've done.
You know, I think there have been some other questions about the trade deadline. I was originally thinking, like, now we're going to have teams moving from sellers into holders mode, where they're not going to sell off the leaves, because, like, white flag trade might not happen if they didn't in the system. We have teams, like, that were kind of holding still and just kind of seeing how they might move into the buyers. So I was thinking, like, the cost of acquiring players for the season would go way up. And I already know how it's about this. I talked about this a couple weeks ago, and they're really good point. The elimination of free agent compensation is essentially an offsetting impact. So we're going to have teams who were holding on to guys. Like last year, San Diego probably just didn't trade well. Like, well, we draft pick for them. It's fine. Let's play up the string for us. So that kind of guys can come on to the market, which will basically replace Pittsburgh and the Heat for something. And I think it might just end up being a wash.
Yeah. I love the idea of the first wild card in the best thing baseball has done back in 1994. I think Rob said it well. It is really a trade-off for opportunity for more teams to compete, but it destroys the value of the wild card. You have right now the wild card, legitimately you could say it's a 1-in-8 chance of winning the World Series. Under the new system, the wild card is what if you want a 16 chance, because you're literally making a book of a toll game. So it will be a crisis in New York if Yankees won the wild card. And that used to actually be incidental for the course of the division. Now it's a lost season getting the wild card, because they have to flip that coin to get through. Now again, I'm with Rob, and that's probably right. You know, I don't think we should people for the Yankees. The second place Yankees, yeah. I do think their days of between 189, you know, near term luxury tax, and the second wild card, I think when you add all this up, I think it does say that, you know, the chances of seeing, you know, the Yankees in the World Series, you know, more than once or twice in the next 10 years are probably pretty slim, I don't think. Plus, I think other teams are catching up to them in a significant way. So I don't have any problem with reducing the value of winning a wild card. I would have probably less of a problem with it if the divisions were a little bit more balanced in the amount of people than they are today. So, you know, again, in the grand scheme of things, I think it's great. And what the wild card will do is essentially legislate that kind of, last day of the season we had this year, in a way, with a 163rd play-in game every year now. And so we didn't lose anything by doing it, because people say, Rob said, we didn't need it this year. Well, we're going to get that every year now with these two wild cards playing against each other.
I do think, too, it'll be interesting to see. I think that the second wild card might incentivize fewer teams to punt seasons. Like, so in the past, we've seen like teams say, I just don't have kids. I'm going to trade up all my kids, not going to be horrible. And those kinds of 55 and 107 seasons can really just destroy fan bases and drive people away from the game. And I think it's good for baseball if fewer teams don't have seasons, say, if we're screwed. And the Astros are going to do that this year. And the Orioles probably do. But the other 20 teams, like with the second wild card, you can concoct like scenarios, even with the A's. Like, Chris Suzuki takes steroids and has 40 home runs, who knows, you know?
Yeah, I want to add something here, though. And to me, the one thing I worry about is teams that kind of fool themselves around the trading deadline or in July into thinking that they're contenders. I mean, like, you know, we're only 8 games back of the wild card. You know, we may still have a shot. Let's hold right now and not make the deals that can give us a better shot next year or that are more in long-term interest of the organization. I think I worry that there are going to be certain teams that, you know, they want to put on a brave face and convince themselves and their fans that they're still in this thing by not making the moves that are the smarter moves. And sometimes I think the smarter move is, you know, making that white flag deal.
I don't think it's going to change that much, especially in the National League, where it basically it's 89-90 wins is what it was before. I mean, there were probably a few teams that do that. I don't know. I'm just guessing, but I don't think it's going to have that much. I don't think it's going to change much during the mindset. The same team basically are going to be still in the National League. Or now it's 89 instead of 91, whatever. I don't think it's going to have that much.
I think I ran the numbers a few weeks ago. The average number one wild card was 92 wins, and the average number two wild card was 89. So it's like a 3-win spread. And I think there are teams who are, you know,
six games out of the wild card previously. It would now be three games out of the second wild card spot that will hold that would have sold otherwise. And I'm going to have a slightly different take on this. I think that's good. I think more teams are in the stretch run. Even if like the last year's Pirates, they fell apart in the second half, Pirates were still up 4,000 in a game.
It's going to create another opportunity for teams that do decide to give up.
Yep.
Because there will be more teams interested in their players.
Right, yeah.
So the price goes up. Right.
I guess what it comes down to is it's tough for us because there's so many variables coming into this that and we're still stuck in this one wild card mindset trying to figure out how, you know,
right.
That there's teams are going to have to, you know, figure out their strategies to adapt to this environment.
Let's talk about some of the teams this year that we think could surprise on the positive or negative side. You know, who do you look to this year that you're sort of surprised you think?
You mean this year's Diamondbacks? We all have a good answer for that one.
No, we don't.
Because you can't know. I think I'll just throw this out there. The Royals, a lot of people like the Royals because they're sincerely talented and they don't need competition. So I think they're
maybe a year or two away?
Yeah, sure. I mean, they have like four or five good pitching prospects and three of those guys develop, but they haven't developed three in the last 15 years, so yeah. I don't know why they would develop three next year. It's possible.
Spoken like a hostile this run.
Oh, not at all.
I'm big on the Nationals. I just wrote about the rotation last week. I mean, that front four with Strasburg, Zimmerman, Edwin Jackson, Gio Gonzalez. I mean, they miss a lot more bats than they missed last year. It's a very different rotation than they had last year. And for the offense, I think there are reasons to be concerned about on base percentage there. But I think, like, you know, I can't see Jason Wood having the same season as he did last year. I think he's gonna rebound at some point. You're gonna add Bryce Harper to that lineup. I don't think he should be starting out, on the roster opening day. But I think those two things. I also think, you know, that Davey Johnson is still a pretty good manager, and that could be something that comes into play. So, to me, they're a very interesting team, and especially with this two wild card format, they're a team that I really want to see how this turns out.
Yeah, the positive side, I think in looking at some of the over-unders on the betting lines, the betting line I saw at 375.5 is an over-under, and I was like, take me over a mile on that one. That just seems really low to me. Quickman's rotation is underrated. I think of people looking at the ball movement as after 1 year of a high ERA where they've been stranded in runners, they've given up on this guy. 2 years ago, this guy was nailed. Yeah. He was unbelievable. And Justin Masterson is legitimately good. Derek Lowe is not nearly great. He's hitting, so the back of the rotation's not bad. They've got some prospects. They've got depth. The Indians' rotation's pretty good. The bullpen's not bad at all. Jason Kipp was a full year from him. They've got that smoother, Chew comes back healthy. There's reasons to think that the Indians can win between 80 and 85 games, and if things go really right, maybe even 90, and kind of chase the Tigers in the AL Central, maybe 75.5, but the Indians just way too low. So that's a team that I think people are really sweeping on a little bit. And I think last year's Diamondbacks are going to be this year's Diamondbacks. I think Arizona will make a big step this year. I think people could even kind of even see that fantastic 24 or 2.5 year right over last year. But if you look at his batting average on balls in play with a man on base, it was like 140. Like when guys were on base, the ball was constantly downfield with us. That's not a skill. He's going to take a good step backwards. I think we have backs the ball back to like deep, low innings.
On the Diamondbacks, the other thing, though, I think while those two guys could regress, the potential improvement that they have mid-season for bringing up Trevor Bauer to replace Cole Turner or Joe Saunders. Yeah, and then they added Cahill. I mean, I think that this is a very different Diamondbacks team already than the one that won last year. And I think having full season Goldschmidt, Hill at second base, I mean, he's a guy who's bought low on a full season of Ryan Roberts at third base. Probably because this pretty good. Just had the most amazing season of his life. It's already a very different team. I look at the NL West and I shake my head at the Dodgers, I shake my head at the Giants, I shake my head at the Rockies. I mean, I still think the Diamondbacks are the last.
Yeah, it's close. I think there's going to be like three teams in the 86 win range, and then one of them is going to get to kind of on that.
What about the opposite? Diamondbacks talk about the Twins. Are they better?
Yeah, the Twins would be
better. I wrote about them from the prospectus annual, and the way that if they end up with an outfielder, Ben Revere is their left fielder, the opportunity cost there of getting a real bat in the lineup
relative to like what his offensive profile is huge. And that was something that's one of my pet peeves that I've been writing about baseball perspectives the last couple of weeks. This tendency to put Scott Cendix and Juan Pierce in left field, thinking like, oh, if we have a speedy left fielder, that's going to make up for the fact that we don't have Adam Dunn out there. And it never does. I mean, you just can't gain that much out of it. They're definitely going to get more out of those two guys. But you know that rotation. I just look at that rotation and shake my head. You never know what you're going to get out of Adriano. And you know, too many guys that don't miss bats.
Jim, do you have an issue with? I'm curious with Brett Gardner and left. Is that situation?
That's one that I wondered about. You know whether they should flip-flop Gardner and Granderson, because if you look at Gardner's defensive metrics are off the charts positive, and Granderson's last year were generally pretty negative. Intuitively, you'd say, yeah, just swap those two guys out. Yankee Stadium has a big left field. But Gardner's arm is not very good, and that's, I think, the reason why they favored that. So I have less issue with that, but I mean, Brett Gardner Brett Gardner 2010 model, it works a lot better than Brett Gardner 2011 model.
You know, I think on clubs, and I wouldn't pick this team as the surprise team, but the Dodgers are a team to watch this year. I think they should be able to hover as a competitive club for the first half of the season, and then with new ownership at the All-Star, by the All-Star break, or by the trade deadline, they could be very active and be the big buyers and really make a move.
You really want Ned Plenty being active with Trent Hunt.
Yeah, as a Dodger fan, I'm just kind of cringing there. I think that's been my motive for the last several years. I look at the Dodgers, I mean, they made a lot of value plays, but they kind of counteracted that by these higher dollar second year of the contest on guys like Tacuano and Harang and Ellis and whatever. I mean, like, all of those guys make for reasonable one-year choices, but when you have that second year that's going to be twice as high, you know, it's like a poison pill for whoever follows it. Like, their flourishing decides that they want to go into depression.
So in terms of my surprise teams, I definitely think the Nationals are a team to be reckoned with. It may be a year early for them, but I do think that they've got some great opportunities this year ahead of them with Jackson, with Gonzalez, all the things that Jay mentioned. I'd also put the Blue Jays in that category. I think Toronto is a team that is coming on. I think Brett Lowry, Paulie Rasmus having a better year, and Henderson Alvarez now in that rotation this season, the whole season. I'm optimistic that I think the Blue Jays can surprise, and I love the Rays. I think the Rays would be in that 38 at least. And I think one of the Yankees or Red Sox will not be the postseason champions.
I've been working on an article on the AL pitching projections for the program. I was really struck, actually. You know, I kind of had in my mind that the Blue Jays might be a sleeper team. The pitching just does not project very well. And a lot of that's because guys like Brett Cecil and Kyle Draper are coming off like just some dreadful years that you couldn't necessarily have anticipated. But there's like an 8 or 9 win gap between what their 5-man rotation is forecast for and what the top, which is the Rangers, and the Rangers or the Red Sox. I went 6 deep on one, 5 deep on one, and they kind of swapped places there. But, I was surprised that the Blue Jays looked so low. But then we know that pitching from a projection standpoint, pitching is very non-linear. I mean, guys think small correction mechanics can be the difference between a 5 ERA and a 3 ERA. Especially once you throw in a little bit of luck there, and you got a new pitch or whatever. I mean, there's just in Kyle Drabeck, for example, I've heard good things about what he's doing in the spring. And that's going to erase last year with the effect of a 6 ERA on his projection, for example. Yeah.
Why don't we open it up to questions from the floor?
Hi. Hi. Great panel. Enjoyed all your work. One thing I looked at, particularly with the Rays and the Twins in past years, and I know the term innings eater pitcher may or may is not a real statistical thing, but there is something, because it's so rare to have 5 starters or 4 or 5 starters pitch 180, 200 innings and get like 26, 30 starts, and it makes sense for teams like the Rays and Twins to do that because it's so expensive and hard for them to bring in pitching during the year. But Is there something to just having someone there to pitch a 180 innings regardless of what, you know, how they perform and how the rest of it turns out?
Well, I would say that should figure as if it's about replacement, right? Isn't that based on what you're measuring? Because
yeah.
In the old days, we just thought, I don't know, I used to think it was a stupid term, pitching, you know, innings a year is like, why would we want a guy with a 4 ERA to put an innings for us? But if the guy behind him has a 5.5 ERA, it's got some value, and I think WAR is supposed to measure that.
I think one of the things that a lot of people don't like when they sort of the WAR leaderboard, they feel like very mediocre pitchers coming out with decent totals, and they're like, this guy's horrible because of all these runs. It's like, yeah, but he stays healthy. Like, you know, Barry Zito, we make fun of that contract, and we should make fun of that contract. But Barry Zito is not been a total zero for the Giants. He hasn't been good, certainly. He hasn't been worth $100 million. But for a few years in the beginning of that contract, he went on there and he threw 200 mediocre innings and kind of kept them from having to, you know, call some kid in double A who's been able to ERA 7 in the bottom form.
Yeah. The alternative to the guys who have got like 450 ERAs in back rotation, the 5 ERAs in back rotation are hard, other guys with the sixes. And the other thing to remember, I mean, especially when it comes to pitching deep into the games, is I think it's for every third of an inning more that your staff averages, that's one 50 inning guy that you don't have to find in the bullpen. Essentially an extra full-time reliever job equivalent. And that's, you know, getting rid of another replacement level guy on your staff.
The one problem with an inning beater and a guy like Zito is that if you have, if this is your pay, the money they pay him, you can't get somebody better.
Yeah, right.
But if that's your only alternative, if that's your option right then, is there value?
I think you want cheap inning beaters. That's kind of thing. You don't want to spend inning beaters. You want cheap ones that you can dump when they're really, really bad.
Well, and to get guys to go deep in the games, you're better off. Get through innings and go deeper. So there's really two separate issues here. One is you use your five starters, or you use a six starter at times and spot them, or you have your five starters just go deeper in the games.
Right.
Right, but then, you know, the term pitch to contact kind of makes me cringe because I'm not even sure how one even teaches some of the pitch to contact unless you could, you know, throw a lot of movement and get guys to not hit the ball solidly on.
Pitch to contact generally means pitch down in the zone. So like if you look at basically the strike zone, up in the zone is swings and misses and fly ball. Down in the zone is swings and contact and ground ball. So pitch to contact is almost always, hey, throw your sinker along the strike zone. That's what pitch to contact means.
You guys didn't mention the Marlins in their fall-in strategy. What do you think about that?
I have this... You know, I have some skepticism about the Marlins just because of the legacy of the things that their ownership has done. That has less to do with this year than it does the long-term plan of signing Reyes and Hurley and bringing in Ozzie Guillen. I think that could explode considerably.
And
Bradley, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of volatility there. At the same time, it's a pretty solid lineup, but I do think that they're going to be a top team. And I guess they're not as interested as the Nationals, but yeah, I think they do probably undervalued them in our little panel here.
I would say put them in the NL West, and that'd be my picture in that division. Put them in the NL East, and they might finish fourth.
They go first.
Or,
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, there are four good teams in that division. Yeah. It's really hard to say which one's going to come out of that. I haven't done the work yet. But even if I didn't have done the work, I wouldn't have any defense more than games.
I think I'd feel like significantly ahead of the other three, but I think those are three.
And what year is the Phillies' age catch up
this year?
I think it already has. I mean, especially if you start the year without Ryan Howard, and granted that was a traumatic injury, not necessarily an age-related thing, but the fact that Puppy's only just nearing the ability to play spring training games or whatever, and like that's a big difference when that team doesn't have those defense.
The thing about the Marlins that's interesting to me is that we make fun of a lot of them often, mostly because of ownership. But I did a little thing for Clubhouse Confidential, which I don't think I actually made the air, but I guess it did. I looked at marginal wins per dollar over the last, I think, 3 years. The Marlins were in the top two or three. I mean, they don't spend money foolishly, typically. So, all these guys they signed, I think he fell a little bit of money today, but I'm not convinced that they waste a lot of their money.
Yeah, I think they spent a little too much on Burley and a lot too much on Bell, but I think they got a deal on Reyes. Like, I know a lot of people are concerned about injury, but I think the Reyes signing was a really good one. And, I think that their offseason plan to go get some really high-profile guys when they move into the stadium and, reboot their franchise is actually a pretty good one.
I wonder what happens though if they don't win this year and next year attendance is down and suddenly they're having a they start taking a fire sale, like, you know, and you've got some of those contacts had no trades in them.
I think they didn't give out anything. That was kind of the sticking point.
Oh, right. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
When we talk about bar, we don't account for the value of a roster spot. So if one team, until September 1st, could go with 26 players, or another team was limited to 24, how many games or fractions of the game would that a difference would you expect that to make?
So I think the thing is, like, on the margins, that 26 guy is going to be very good. You know, so if you add, can you add another pinch runner? I mean, that might add you a half a win over a year. I mean, I think even if optimal roster management, if you give him a 13th reliever or, you know, some kind of lefty platoon bat who's a 4A guy, it's not going to help that much. I think I would say no more.
Yeah, you're trolling in the replacement level pool. In most cases, there are very few players that are probably worth more than a full win over the course of a year and get completely shut out of major league playing time for, you know, when they're ready, I think. I think you'll gain a little bit, but it's going to take a sophisticated man. It takes a sophisticated manager to play the matchups correctly and to pick those spots. You know, there are certain managers I wouldn't give that extra weapon to at all because it would inevitably blow up.
In terms of next, yeah, I mean, this year we're going to have this new playoff system.
Yes,
we're going to have a new playoff system, and yes, it's going to change again next year when we switch the Astros to the American League. And is it going to be like 6-5 team divisions, or is it just going to be one big division in each league?
The Astros are going to have 6-5. Yeah, the Astros are going to now finish
playing the Mariners,
so we won't be
lost. Okay, but that means there'll have to be interleague play every day. So how is that going to affect game preparation and things like that, especially?
I heard one coach say he's actually really bothered by this change because now he's going to have to have his pitcher take batting practice all year long. Like, originally they were able to just, like, clump it in 2 weeks and, like, okay, Felix, go take your swing now and try not to get hurt. I mean, now they're going to have to do it all year long. And, like, for the manager, like, it's like an annoyance, but they'll figure it out.
And when they go into the major league, they're going to either choose either DH in both leagues or no DH in either league.
I think this is a prelude to making a decision one way or the other. I think I wrote about this last week. I think it should be moving towards a different kind of adopting the age of the leagues. Injuries to pitchers, batting, and running the bases are just stupid. You know, I'm tired of seeing Yankees alone over the last few years. I mean, you know, like Shannon Wall running the bases, and, you know, ex Yankees getting hurt, Dustin Mosley getting hurt. I mean, not that all these guys are great players, but are aging or not. You know, that was like, why should we be losing good players or even mediocre players to injuries that are completely preventable because we're forcing them to do something for which they're inherently, at this point, unqualified.
I heard about this last week as well. I can't read other people's stuff. Don't feel bad about that. I think it's inevitable, but it might take 10 or 20 years. The premise was that it will happen when we have radical realignment. The reason it's not going to happen for a while is because none of the National League teams want to switch, and most of the National League pitchers don't want to switch. You need buy-in on both sides, and I don't see people are close to it. But it will happen. You're right, it's inevitable. It's a question of that.
You know, something I had talked about on the show a couple weeks ago was this idea that we saw in spades this year, that the big power bats, when they go to free agency, will probably continue to invariably end up in the American League. And maybe under the illusion that you can transfer the player to the DH for the back end of his contract, because these are typically the big power bats are getting long-term deals. I'm not saying that that's the right place where they should be, but that's the illusion. I mean, how do the, unless you do a, you know, a pre-arb deal or an arb deal on Ryan Braun, how do you keep these large bats?
Well, here's the thing, though. All it takes is one or two, like, if the Pujols and Braun deals blow up, There won't be any more of those 8 or 10 year deals for a while.
There will be a backlash.
Yeah. But you're right, I mean, that is the trend right now for sure.
So it's interesting that the A-Rod deal didn't seem to scare Fubal's.
A good point.
But you've also got the biggest spending teams are all in AL now, and Yankees, Red Sox, I mean, long term, the Angels, the TV deal, and the Rangers, the TV deal. I mean, like, there's a lot more money being spent in the AL right
now. I think that's destined to shift back with the Dodgers becoming a real force, the Cubs maturing to the point that they're willing to spend the ample resources that they have, and when the Mets. Financial situation, ownership situation gets settled. I mean, I would think those three teams can be big players.
And the Phillies are already. Yeah. In fact, in the early 70s, it was exactly the opposite. The reason that American League went to the DH because if they weren't drawing any fans, they didn't have any money. And it totally flipped.
I have no axe to grind here. I'm totally neutral to this team, but I'm wondering about the Tigers coming up. They spend a huge bucks on the first field, and they've got a dynamite lineup up and down, and then they got a defensive fielder, Rayburn, of Johnny Peralta and Cabrera. How does that all fit together?
I don't know. They actually do have an awesome lineup. They have a really good middle of the order. Yeah. Top and bottom of the order is not good. I took a lot of crap out for the fielder signing. So I think the Tigers are fairly overrated. I think they'll win that division because they're not very good. This is not an elite American League team. Two good hitters. A bunch of okay role players on the position side, a pretty good but not great starting rotation, a mediocre bullpen, and the worst bullpen game on their team.
And if you ask Greg at the back there after this panel here, he might tell you Chris Fielder is not perfectly suited to that ballpark either. I mean, that could be a bad deal. That could look really bad for them. Yeah.
I think that short term, they'll outhit them defensive mistakes. They've also got other options at second base. I mean, Rayburn's not locked in at second base. They're trying in there. Ownership's proven that they're willing to spend the money, so they can go out and get a second baseman in mid-season if that's a problem. I think they have a lot of moving parts there in that lineup. There's some flexibility to adapt as the, if they say right now that they want to play Miguel Cabrera at third base all year, 50 games into the season, they may have to revisit that and do something to save face if that's really, really, really not working.
In the short-term days, right, they're in with the division, and maybe next year, too. 3 years down the road, with all the guys they have in the payroll, they might be third or fourth place. I don't know, 2015.
And to Dave's point, last year, the Tigers needed help over and they went out and got Delvin Young.
So just because they can go get a second base, that doesn't mean they're going to get a good one.
Yeah.
It worked.
It worked.
And their questionable defense could really chew up that pitching staff and extend it.
It's the wrong pitching staff profile for that infield. That I will definitely agree on that.
For Porcello, it's a disaster. And it's a shame that Spister had such a tremendous year in the right infield. He probably understood that better than maybe the rest of us.
And Brubeck was a regret, too.
Yeah, he was there.
Was so low.
It's very tough. I mean, when you're elite level, you're regress.
How about one last question?
If you don't mind, I'm going to venture into the new CBA, so fact check me if I'm wrong, but regarding the Latin American, the new spending caps, when I took a little time to think about the consequences of that, it differed a little bit from, I think, the consensus I heard there, which was that it discourages teams from spending scouting and big fancy academies in those areas, but if anything, I almost thought it would emphasize, in particular the scouting, and rather than being able to spend $5 million on one particularly talented player, you have to sort of sift through the masses and have people that can pick out the hidden gems in the middle of them. The guys like Miguel Montero sticks out, he's at $10,000 or $15,000, so you can find really good talent if you have the scouts.
And there's no cap on scouting. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I think you're right. That's an excellent point. As we were saying with the wild card, we have a tendency to view these things through the framework of what we know has just happened, and teams are already in their boardrooms plotting how to deal with these new strategies, and they're probably ahead of us in figuring out how to adapt these new challenges.
To me, the interesting thing about this issue is right now we have between 5 and 15 a year multi-billion dollar international 16-year-old free agents. Most of those are the Rangers. But I think it's going to be interesting to see if teams now say, okay, for this coming year, they have like $2.5 million total. That's all you can spend. So do teams just buy a copy of Baseball America and see who better battle rates is 5 to 15 and offer them $2.5 million to that guy and do no work whatsoever? And you say, hey, look, I've got $2.5 million, I got more than anyone else trying to spread it around and find gems and, you know, scout really hard. And I shut down my academy, so I fire all my scouts and I reallocate all that money to my major league people. And I just signed the one guy who Baseball America told me was pretty good. Because I think that you could probably do okay doing that, just signing one guy a year for your total allocation of money and just kill your international scouting bonus. But completely and not be destroyed by the system. I think that's important.
Okay, folks, great. Thanks so much. We appreciate it.